And we're back with another segment of the Reporter's File. Many thanks for joining us. My name is Saeed Puriza, and these are the headlines. A pilgrimage that threatens the pristine Indian-controlled Kashmir Himalayas. How rich is Afghanistan, a country ravaged by decades of war? The Iraqi Kurdistan Legislative Election 2013. And a real estate crisis in Uganda. The recent natural catastrophe that hit the Indian state of Uttarakhand has brought in sharp focus the Himalayas in the Kashmir Valley, home to a Hindu religious shrine. As Ali Safi reports, the glaciers in the area are melting alarmingly, and environmentalists fear that the ecologically fragile areas in the region are going to bear the full brunt if the authorities fail to regulate the unprecedented flow of pilgrims to the cave shrine.
Every year, hundreds of thousands of people trek along the rugged and treacherous terrain to the cave shrine that houses the ice stalagmite believed to be the symbol of Hindu deity Lord Shiva. The cave shrine is located at an altitude of 3,880 meters from sea level in the southern Kashmir Himalayas. The annual pilgrimage site for Hindus, locally known as Amarnath Yatra, is considered to be one of the holiest shrines in Hinduism. According to historians, the cave shrine has been a place of worship since times immemorial, but in the Middle Ages the shrine was forgotten by people, only to be rediscovered by a Muslim shepherd in the 15th century.
I paid obeisance at Amarnath Cave Shrine. I feel so good and feel indebted to our Muslim brothers for their service, without which I feel this yatra would not be successful.
This is one of the most sacred Hindu pilgrimage sites. I have come here to perform puja with my family and get blessings of Lord Shiva.
The pilgrimage has long been a symbol of communal amity and secular bonhomie, with Muslims of Kashmir offering their services to facilitate the pilgrimage. The pilgrims halt at base camps at Baltal and Pahalgam before embarking to higher slopes. While many pilgrims prefer trekking to the hallowed spot, some ride on horsebacks or carriers lifted by men to reach the cave shrine. The affluent ones who can afford to spend money fly to cave shrine in helicopters, which cost them $100. In the year 2000, the federal government of Kashmir, headed by the then Chief Minister Farooq Abdullah, created the Shri Amarnath Shrine Board to manage the affairs of the annual Hindu pilgrimage to Amarnath Grave Shrine. The move was criticized by many in Kashmir, who termed it as an attempt to politicize the pilgrimage.
The Amarnath Shrine Board has become a parallel government, in a sense that they are taking decisions on their own and not taking into consideration any aspects of the local concerns people have.
It's a state within state. They are bypassing the local government and they are taking the dictation from Home Ministry of India.
Earlier, the annual Hindu pilgrimage was a week-long low-key affair, but since a few years, the pilgrimage period has been increased to 3 months, in which over 500,000 Hindu pilgrims from across the world flock to the cave shrine annually.
It used to be confined to visit of certain sadhus, certain Hindu religious personalities, which didn't exceed beyond 10,000 up to 1989. After 1990, and with the advent of BJP government in New Delhi, they perceived it to be a way of asserting their claim to Kashmir, same way as Jews are asserting their claim to Palestine. They mobilized people within mainland India to visit this place so that tomorrow they can claim Kashmir on another count.
In May 2008, the government decided to transfer 100 acres of forest land to the Amarnath Shrine Board, to set up temporary shelters and facilities for pilgrims. The decision raised many eyebrows and triggered protests across the region as people saw the government orders as a conspiracy to change the demography of the valley. Over the years, the huge influx of pilgrims into the fragile ecosystem has disturbed the ecological balance, wildlife habitat, and has affected the nearby glaciers, putting Kashmir on the brink of an impending disaster. Over 200 pilgrims perished due to the devastating natural calamity in 1996, but even that failed to jolt authorities out of their slumber. The devastating flooding in northern Indian state of Uttarakhand this year, in which hundreds of people perished, has once again raised concerns in Kashmir, where experts foresee similar destruction if the number of pilgrims to ecologically sensitive Himalayas is not regulated. Tons of solid waste are littered along the pilgrimage route, which is polluting the otherwise crystal clear glacial lakes, giving rise to waterborne diseases. Worse, the use of helicopters in the fragile ecosystem is disturbing the ecological balance. The glaciers are fast melting, and experts say if the rate of receding of glaciers continues at the current pace, there will be water shortage not only in Kashmir, but also in other parts of South Asia, which depend on the river waters of Kashmir. Pertinently, Kolohai Glacier, which is Kashmir's biggest glacier and the region's only permanent water source, is melting fast. In the past 3 decades, the glacier, spread over just a little above 11 square kilometers, has shrunk 2.63 square kilometers. Another glacier, namely Thajwas Glacier, is also receding fast, raising concerns about future. Experts have long been calling for a policy to regulate the flow of pilgrims into the pristine Himalayas on patterns of China's Kailash Mansarovar and Gangotri and shorten the period of pilgrimage to limit any environment damage.
Supreme Court of India has directed that not more than 150 yatris must visit Gangotri Glacier. In case of Kashmir, there is no such limitation.
As Muslims, the majority inhabitants of the state of Jammu and Kashmir, we have never been against yatra for any religious reason. We believe that there has to be a policy in terms of not only vis-a-vis having a time frame for the yatra, but also limiting the number of pilgrims or yatris who come for this yatra.
The massive influx of pilgrims has raised some serious concerns about the fragility of environment, abysmal ecological balance, and the melting glaciers. Environment experts have called on the government to regulate the flow of pilgrims to prevent any damage to the ecosystem. But so far, the government remains unmoved. Sayed Ali Safi, reporting for Reporters File, Indian-controlled Kashmir.
Afghanistan, often dismissed as an impoverished and failed state, is sitting on $1 trillion worth of untapped minerals. They say if there is a road to a happy ending in Afghanistan, much of the path may run underground in the trillion-dollar reservoir of natural resources. That has brought happy news and also hopes of a more self-sufficient country, only if that wealth can be wrested from blood-soaked soil. Amin Alami reports.
Afghanistan is a mountainous country which has huge caches of mineral wealth in form of gold, copper, iron, lithium, and many more valuable stones and metals. For example, one of the world's largest iron mines is located here in central Bamiyan province of Afghanistan, while one of the world's largest lithium reserves as a key metal for batteries is also located here in Nawar district of southern Ghazni province. But due to current political and security situation in Afghanistan, the politics likely will be the deciding factor. To find out about one of the world's largest untapped lithium mines, we took a trip to Nawar district in Ghazni province. Syed Jan Agha is a well-known landholder in his village called Sabzlana or the Greenhouse in Nawar district. The population in this district is over 120,000 people. Most of them are simple farmers who live their lives with less income. But being of such huge wealth in their district could not create any optimism among them for future.
The central government does not have enough ability to manage the extraction of mines. This government has also failed to provide security for us. But we know that this is the US that is stealing our natural deposits, and the government does not apparently know about this.
Unfortunately, Unfortunately, the US is not only dishonest with our people, but it also wants to ravage our national wealth, which is being buried in the heart of our country's giant mountains.
Based on statistics, Afghanistan's gross domestic product is only about $12 billion. In such circumstances, if the mineral deposits of the country being extracted, Afghanistan could be transformed into one of the important mining centers in the world. And of course, as Afghanistan's mines are so big and included so many materials that are essential to modern industry, it could attract heavy investment, providing jobs for millions of Afghans. Despite this, Afghans blame both the US and the Afghan government for what they name it mismanagement and ravaging of their natural wealth.
There is no rule of law in most of our country's provinces, and especially in remote areas like here. The government could not provide us the basic needs, like roads and health services. In this case, the independent extraction of mines by the government seems like a joke for me.
We admit that Afghanistan is not a sovereign state. Everything is in the hand of occupiers. Occupiers are doing and they are looting, they are taking every very precious mines of Afghanistan to America and to Europe. And this is against the law, against the international law, against the human rights law.
The US has previously declared that Afghanistan's mineral resources are worth $1 trillion, but the Afghan government does not accept the result of Pentagon's geological survey on Afghanistan's mineral wealth.
Very conservative estimate has been $1 trillion. But our estimation has been more than that. And although it's not been confirmed yet, that is subject to more exploration and drilling on the ground.
Having huge deposits of lithium is not the only reason that has changed Nawar district into an important place and, of course, a different place.
Dasht-e-Nawar or Nawar Desert is also known as Afghanistan's second national park. Apart from the other natural views of this amazing desert, there are tens of lakes hosting different kinds of birds from across the world each year. But unfortunately, the local people and visitors from the neighboring districts hunt them in large numbers without paying attention to the environmental effects of such hunting.
Hamid is a local resident of Nawar district. He gets to lakes to hunt ducks sometimes, he says.
This area is full of different kinds of birds like ducks. Hunting of ducks is very interesting for me, but some others hunt everything from ducks to white eagles, which are being sold in high prices.
Although 75% of the Afghan territory is being covered by different kinds of natural resources, but this is also worth mentioning that in spite of heavy presence of tens of thousands of so-called international security assistance forces in Afghanistan since 2001, Afghans are not only facing with more insecurity, but they are the witness of an increase in number of drug addicts, as well as they are suffering from joblessness and poverty. That is why the poverty is everywhere to see here. For Reporters File, Amin Alami, Nawar District in Southern Ghazni Province.
Election fever is hotting up in Iraqi Kurdistan's three provinces. The parliamentary election will go ahead as planned this month after months of speculation about possible delays. Reporters File speaks with candidates from the region's three Islamic parties to find out about their plans, who they are, why they're running, and what changes they're offering. Dale McEwen reports.
The parliamentary election in Iraq's Kurdistan region will take place on September 21st. Over 1,000 candidates from dozens of parties are competing for 111 seats.
This is Kurdistan's third parliamentary election since Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was toppled. Reporters File spoke to candidates from Kurdistan's Islamic parties. Members of the Islamic parties say they're eager to implement real change.
The opposition Islamic Union has nominated 89 candidates for the election.
If we can create a very active and capable parliament without the party's funds and without party bias, then we could have an academic and powerful parliament. And surely society would then develop. Personally, I'd like to work in the Human Rights Committee or the Integrity Committee, because nowadays the Kurdish community suffers from these two things. Corruption would disappear if we created a developed Integrity Committee and investigated everyone from the president down to a less powerful member of Kurdistan's government authority.
Kumria Muhammad from the opposition Islamic Group has over 25 years of experience in politics. She says that working as a member of parliament is her duty rather than her right.
It's my desire to use the financial privileges that they give to me to help poor people and the people who need me. I have a plan to use the salary that I get from being a teacher. I will use just that bit and use the rest to serve poor people and the youth. I will try to defend legally all of the true rights of the youth, women and disabled people. I want to offer a health loan project for citizens, and I want to have a project for teachers. I know there are a lot of teachers who may be think that they've not achieved their rights. I will try to make one of my projects a transparency project for the budget and income.
The Islamic movement won two seats in the 2009 polls. The party joined the government's cabinet and was given the Ministry of Endowment and Religious Affairs. Shwan Khalidzai is the head of the movement's election list.
The Islamic movement is managed by a group of well-known Iraqi Muslim scholars and world scholars. Among them, the top one is the cleric teacher Uthman and many other famous men. Our main work in the parliament is to reflect Islamic religion in all parts of politics, the government, the ministries, and the security institutions. We try to develop the livelihood of people in the Kurdistan region and make a government that's above the reach of parties' grips. We try to create a parliament that's really representative of all people in the Kurdistan region.
Kurdistan's Islamic Group and Islamic Union won 10 seats in the 2009 polls after running together. The three Islamic parties are now running separately, but they all agree that Kurdistan's politics needs to be shaken up. Inflation nearly tripled last year, according to the region's statistics department. There were deadly riots in 2011 against alleged government corruption.
Do not keep the strategic agreement between the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which they've had up until now. They made this agreement for the party's benefit.
The thing that's very clear for all of the parties today is that the two ruling parties are manipulating the authority. All of us should try to stop the manipulation of the authority.
The Islamic parties are also united on any attempts to remove Islam from Kurdistan's draft constitution. Article 6 of the constitution is up for debate, along with the other articles. The article stipulates that Islamic Sharia is the basic source of legislation. Opponents argue that Islam is only one source of legislation. The other sources should be based on democracy.
We are pressurizing and using our ability to defend this article to keep it in the constitution, because 95% of Kurdistan's society is Muslim.
Kurdistan's September parliamentary election is slated to be a real turning point for the region's politics. The two ruling parties are running on separate lists. It's unclear who will form the next government, but other observers remain skeptical, believing that Kurdistan's politics will not change dramatically. Dale McEwen, Reporters File, Arbil. We'll be right back.
The real estate industry has for years been one of the highest paying ventures in Uganda. But in the past few months, it has come under threat. There are fears among real estate dealers that the industry may collapse as bank interest rates skyrocket beyond the means of many Ugandans. From Kampala, Daniel Arampoy reports.
The commercial real estate market worldwide is increasingly dominated by institutional investors, thus presenting a challenge to private real estate investments. Because individual properties are not bought and sold on a regular basis like stocks and bonds. Unlike the developed countries that use stocks and bonds, financing of real estate in Uganda is predominantly through mortgage financing. State intervention in Uganda has not been forthcoming, with many real estate dealers now giving up hope as land acquisition for real estate development becomes difficult. Another problem presents itself through the management of land's registration, with real estate companies failing to harmonize their relationship with the country's lands ministry as well as buyers and sellers.
Because our biggest problem is in acquiring land and plan it. Because at times acquiring land becomes a problem because you are not aware, you are not this. Then by the time you buy the land and you build houses after some time, government can come and say, here, this place, we have planned to use it for a railway line, or we have planned to put there a power line. So, for that matter, remove your houses.
There is also no regulatory framework governing the operations of real estate industry in Uganda, further worsening the already bad situation. At the height of inflation a year ago, Uganda's central bank introduced an inflation targeting tool on land transaction. The directive was that land transaction above $20,000 should be taxed, prompting the country's revenue body to impose value-added tax on all land transactions, including estates that were bought before the tax came into force. The question of land has become so political that squatters have on several occasions been driven off their land as real estate companies seek expansion. But with recent intervention by government in an attempt to protect landowners, real estate companies have found it difficult to acquire huge chunks of land for real estate development. The country also faces the problem of fake land titles. An issue, if not resolved, could substantially affect the industry.
If we find that there was the landlord had fraudulently acquired the title, then we shall recommend at the end of the day, basing on sufficient evidence, for the cancellation of their titles.
Real estate dealers are also grappling with high bank lending rates after acquiring huge loans, with many small estate dealers losing their properties because of high lending rates.
We need big capital as real estate companies, but the interest rate is so high that it becomes so hard for us to pay the banks. So most of the real estate companies that have been coming up, many of them have collapsed just because they can't pay the banks. And as a result, we are all struggling to make ends meet.
Less than a year ago, the lending rate stood at about 36%, with buyers using commercial bank loans, which are expensive. Although the rates have been reducing slowly, many estate dealers have already had their properties taken over by banks.
One of the biggest challenges in Uganda's real estate industry development is the failure by government to provide incentives, coupled with the inability of the citizens to purchase property, since most of the houses are way beyond their financial capability.
The underfunding by government presents a serious challenge, with billions needed for investments in infrastructure. Real estate experts, however, argue that areas where funding problems aren't as severe will be able to make the infrastructure and quality of life investments that encourage real estate investment. With the poor infrastructure development like roads, some economists say
The honest solution for a third world economy like Uganda is to introduce a public-private partnership with state and local governments to supplement government funding for future generation infrastructure development. The inability to establish a vibrant road network and reliable electricity supply have also hit hard the real estate industry in Uganda. Unlike in neighboring countries where the government provides roads, water and electricity for massive investments of between 100 to 500 houses. Uganda government has not been helpful in this, killing large-scale real estate development. The latest threat to the real estate industry in Uganda is the move by the government to launch investigation into alleged land grabbing by real estate companies, leading to closure of some companies. The country's police is now conducting a countrywide investigations into the claims.
I think as soon as we expedite our investigations into this matter and a report is submitted to the Inspector General of Police and consequently the President, a position will be pronounced and we shall have gotten a permanent solution for the problem that is existing in our community so far.
The real estate developers, however, remain optimistic that the response to these trends will separate the winners from the losers in the real estate market. But some say to solve some of the key issues in real estate, broad consensus is needed, as developers fear that political gridlock could increase the overall uncertainty on how they are going to solve big problems, including funding infrastructure development. Daniel Arap Moi, Reporters File, Kampala, Uganda.
And that does it for this Reporters File, everyone. It's been great having you with us here on Press TV. Make sure you join us again next week as well. So long.